Good morning, Prince. Can you hear me clearly?
Yep.
Great. Welcome to ULT in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And as is our custom, to familiarize you with the aim and the purpose and the policy of this lodge. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It's loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but doesn't concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it to time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose in teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now we just paused a second to show you our little pamphlet, which you can pick up at the book table, at the usher's table, and we'll use a big word, peruse, or go over it, or read it for yourselves. Because to spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy, as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, takes a little time. And therefore, we have two meetings a week in these rooms, and where we do that particular study. As you see, we open promptly at 11 today. It's our understanding that the doors were open at 10:30 so that you could come in, rest, before the meeting began promptly at 11. The topic today, which is June the 3rd, under the title of Practical Theosophy, is called Practical Spiritual Goals. Listen. We have another meeting on Wednesday evenings. Doors open at 5:15, so that you can come in, visit our library, which is the big room on the front, go over our books and so forth, and find out what the topic will be for that evening. Of course, naturally, you'll see people sitting at the table. You have an usher here, and in the library on Wednesday night, another volunteer is there to help you with your choices. And as you come in here, you notice there's a book table and a book bin and everything else. That volunteer will help you. Please. Always remember, those you see on the platform, usher's chair, are volunteers. However, it's supported all by voluntary contribution. That includes money, time, and work, but no obligation is imposed or implied. The present time on Wednesday evenings, we're studying From the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. Those names, Robert Crosby, William Q. Judge, and H.P. Blavatsky, you will hear in these rooms. We think we covered everything in that respect. And as is our custom, before we begin, we have a small comment or reading for you. And it is taken from that wonderful little book called Bhagavad Gita, which you can find on Wednesday evening in our library. From the Bhagavad Gita, incidentally, it's from the last chapter, chapter 18. Imbued with pure discrimination, restraining himself with resolution, having rejected the charms of sound and other objects of the senses, and casting off attachment and dislike, dwelling in secluded places, eating little, with speech, body, and mind controlled, engaging in constant meditation, and unwaveringly fixed in dispassion, abandoning egotism, arrogance, violence, vanity, desire, anger, pride, and possession, with calmness ever present, a man is fitted to be the Supreme Being. And having thus attained to the Supreme, he is serene, sorrowing no more, no more desiring. But alike towards all creatures, he attains the supreme devotion to me. By this devotion to me, he knoweth fundamentally who and what I am. And having thus discovered me, he enters into me without any intermediate condition. And even the man who's always engaged in action shall attain by my favor to the eternal and incorruptible, imperishable abode, if he puts his trust in me alone.
Thank you. Here's your turn. Well, June is going to be a wonderful month, culminating our winter session, and the whole concept of practical theosophy, something that we can develop together and then use during the summer months as we rest up for the next winter session, will be quite something. But today our title to consider together is Practical Spiritual Goals. After a lifetime or even a prolonged period of experiences, both pleasurable and painful, some folks come to a place of discontent with external goals of life and begin to seek the solace of an internal, intrinsic set of goals and drivers. Dissatisfaction can be transformed into determination. A few such seekers come to the pages of the ancient text, the Bhagavad Gita, and hearing the opening of today's reading, become momentarily stunned. So let's hold that in our minds again. Imbued with pure discrimination, restraining himself with resolution, having rejected the charms of sound and other objects of senses, and casting off attachment and dislike, dwelling in secluded places, eating little, with speech, body, and mind controlled, engaging in constant meditation and unwaveringly fixed in dispassion, abandoning egotism, arrogance, violence, vanity, desire, anger, pride, and possession, with calmness ever present, a man is fitted to be the Supreme Being. And for oh so many, both initially and in the ongoing years of studying the Gita, a reaction is, what was that? Whoa, wait a minute. Where do we begin to achieve that kind of spiritual goal or ideal? As the perceiver, as soul, we work with what we have. Dual in nature, both spiritual and animal, we use our brains to reason from premise to conclusion, and most commonly we move that way in a process of observing, identifying, quantifying, trying to describe something to others. For some, there is a gradual shift from that use of brain to heeding the voice of the silence, direct cognition, intuition. But most all of us, as students of the path, as students of the philosophy of theosophy, whether we're first using reason, whether we're seeking intuition, whether we have a flash of intuition, trying to uplift our reasoning abilities, we struggle with the process that's embodied in today's title. Practical living is what it is, but practical spiritual goals is almost an oxymoron for most of us. Goals appeal to the lower nature, the lower mind, very definitely. We seek to set milestones that are observable, measurable, quantifiable, action-based, maybe something we can keep a journal record of. And at that level, a goal is what we think about as an object of ambition or effort. It's a desired aim. And that would be from the lower perspective of the personal man. Spiritual, from the heart, from the soul, far beyond pure intellect, we sense the hunger within. Often we'll say that somebody has a hole in their heart. They're missing something. They're in search of something. And that hunger frequently arises even when all the materialistic goals of life are fully met. And we hear this among kids graduating from high school, from elders who are retiring. Is this all there is? What was that all about? Who am I really? Why am I? Why are we? And so begins the process of searching in the pages of the Gita, the pondering. Where do I begin to figure out what spirit is? Or where do I begin to set goals that are transformative, that rise from the physical and the personal and reach toward the all, the ideal, the spiritual? And there's so many different ways to pursue that during the reference library hours. Somebody could turn to the writings of Crosby or to Judge or to Wadia. For the purposes this morning, we're going to turn toward the objects and the fundamentals that Blavatsky brought forth and that Crosby polished up for us in the Declaration. So looking at all of those sources, we begin to realize that both the loftiest ideal and the most simple, basic, real, the infinite and the finite, lie before us. And as soul, where do we truly live? But in our minds. Our perceptions and assumptions about the nature of things form and contain our ideas, our words contain and limit our ideas. And we know from scientists working in the field of brain research, psychology, psychiatry, there are terms that are applied to the process. Self-fulfilling prophecy is one of them. Power is in the pause, might be heard in some self-help groups. The self-actualizing adult lays out a path for another school of thought. And certainly from the ancient Platonic and Neoplatonic schools, we have the notion that ideas rule the world. A companion recently looked at the title for this morning. This is someone who knows of theosophy but is not engaged, and with no foreknowledge said, I guess you will be talking about developing character and how to live without hurting another. And that was kind of a tickling experience, because the ideas that we need are embedded within the soul. We simply need to draw them out and to make them manifest, but the work begins within mind and soul. Now, we said before that, you know, we bloom where we are planted. We are where we need to be. We each face the results of past karma. We have skandhas that we work through, gunas that we work through. We're swimming in an ocean, almost a pressure cooker, of the common environment of thinking and desire. And we're to bloom where we're planted. We don't have to pull the plant up by the roots. We're not going to paralyze ourselves by analyzing. But we do need to follow a natural path of existence to face our duties as they come to us. We do need to seek sustenance for mind, body, and soul. And we do need to go with the flow of nature, to be observant and aware, and to watch, to listen, to wait, to think about how we are to proceed, both as an individual and as an associate or a member of a group. So let's revisit again the declaration from this morning and then think about it. That's a declared cumulative, collective effort at setting goals. And let's think about some of the main points in terms of how we as private individuals in our daily lives may take some of those statements and transmute them, reapply them as spiritual goals that we can pursue. One statement that immediately came to mind was that this is an independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment, without concerns, without dissensions or differences of individual opinion. And within that collective statement, we have food for thought for ourselves in setting spiritual goals. As we think our way through any practical day with any array of problems or duties before us, can we strive, maybe in a morning quiet time of meditation and reflection on what life with theosophy as a living power might be like, can we periodically through the day, as we meet each new challenge or duty or appointment, whatever it happens to be, can we revisit the fundamental propositions of the philosophy and therefore hesitate in responding to the environment, pull back a little bit, and then consider what's the best course here? Is it keeping silent? Is it asking somebody a Socratic question? Is it offering a reference or some advice? Which way do I go? And again, that's an independent, individual kind of effort based on a philosophy and holding that philosophy in mind as best we can until the end of the day, when we might be able to set aside some time to reflect back on the day, the motives we held, the incidents of life, and then how we responded and interacted with that event. Another major point in the declaration is this: that work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. As we meet our daily duties, wherever we are, can we not have the spiritual aim, the desire to test out oneness, empathy, altruism. Frequently when we care deeply about something, trying to do the best thing for a companion in life, our lower natures can get riled up. We can almost sound like we're angry or frustrated or dictatorial. We want to fix it, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. If we would take the time to wait for a minute, with the old adage of count to 10, or as they do on Daniel Tiger now for toddlers, count to 4, can't we see the oneness of soul to sense what our Indian brothers and sisters state in the word of namaste? Can't we see that in all moments and all departments of life? If we encounter something that really causes us to fret, we're really worried about the well-being of another human being, and we sense all the fibers of our being rising up in activity or rajasic or anger or strong emotion, whatever it happens to be. If we pause for a moment and think we are one, regardless of the apparent differences, we are one, what would help me if I were in the same circumstance? And then offer that methodically and calmly to the other. And then wait to see, was that the right way to help or not? In the process of doing that, in the process of living life as though we are one with the other that we encounter, we are disseminating the idea of unity beyond our words, beyond our ideas. We are disseminating all those notions in our facial expressions, our body language, the tone of our voice, everything about the way we emote to the other. We do no harm, but rather we empower the other to help themselves. And further, don't we have a good fortune to live close enough to this facility that we can come together in a regular, periodic gathering where our minds and hearts are tuned in and focused on the idea of unity and universal brotherhood and what it is to practice universal brotherhood, to feel empathy, to do altruistic acts. And therefore, as we generate energy together this morning, as we look over this title together in a few minutes, are we not seeking to promote unity and serenity, not only in the presence of fellow seekers and students here, but aren't we like a radio station transmitting those spiritual forces, those heartfelt energies, if you will, out into the general public and beyond? Another point in the declaration that we share as an association of free thinkers is that ULT recognizes theosophists, all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And there too is another idea that we could carry forth into practical life every day, in our homes, in workplaces, on the street, even in traffic. If we move through daily lives and experience confusion or frustration with the actions or thinking of others, if we find ourselves frustrated to the point of anger with somebody else and how they're doing, quote, their duty, there is the red flag. There's the signal that we've lost our spiritual goal, that we need to pause, recenter, and think again. If we are all indeed one, and if we make the effort to try to see the oneness behind the diversity, to celebrate the beautiful array of nature and karma that we represent to each other and for each other. That kind of thinking raises practical daily living to a very high level, to a celebratory level, moment by moment, person by person, animal by animal, meal by meal, etc., etc., etc. But that celebration of the oneness behind diversity provides an education, provides a lab in which we can experiment in life, but provides incredible opportunity for insight into spiritual domains. And finally, there's another point in the declaration that if we ponder it enough and take it home as a solo independent thinker and student, we really have an insight into this morning's title. ULT welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach all. Is that not one of the most spiritual goals, not an oxymoron, but a reality that we can have in our lives? The Lodge is a pragmatic association of kindred souls, free thinkers, and can we not in our daily lives fulfill this clause privately, in our private lives, personal lives, and in very practical ways? To fit ourselves is, as my companion pointed out, character development and the evolution of soul expanding to the point that it can be expressed in the physical and the personal. Isn't the ongoing effort to examine our motives, to understand or to first recognize our habitual responses to challenges or obstacles, to recognize them, become aware of them, and then to determine, is that our usual way of responding and interacting with the outside world? And that fit ourselves, isn't that the way, the path to seek when trying to lead a purer life, a better life? Study, we're invited to study. Study comes in many, many shapes and forms. We're all using skandhas, we're all using different brains that by karma are perfect for the acquirement of experience in this incarnation. And they differ. We have different tendencies. So we may have to determine what's our learning style. For some of us, it's movement. For others of us, it's reading poetry or playing music. For some of us, it's outlining what we're a data-dense textbook. For others, it's interaction with people. It's the group discussion and the verbal exchange of ideas that's the best way to study. Whatever it is that we determine is our path to trying to study, to prepare, to help others, each conversation, each experience can uplift the impulse of life as we sense them within us. And again, that spiritual message embedded in the declaration is that we are to help and teach others. We may be in a state where, for whatever reason, just right now, we're unsure of an idea in the philosophy, or maybe we're reading about a particular premise or fundamental, and we just don't yet know how to say it, or we just don't really, English is not really good for carrying some of these words to somebody else. But we can honestly state in the face of any dilemma that we might encounter with a friend or a companion or a stranger, you know, I've been reading about something, or I heard about this idea, and I'm considering it and thinking about it, the idea or the concept might be perfect. It might be something that might help you too. And in that way, we are a help. We're one little link in the chain, in the Guru and Parapara chain. We do what we can to help the one next to us that needs a little boost up, no matter how humble the boost may seem. We remain open and aware of the universe and the way it speaks to us so that we're ready to receive the help that's necessary for where we are in our development. And we're left in that mysterious statement at the end of the declaration. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and to all. The true student of theosophy knows that pure motive, kind thinking, idealistic love, patience with our own flaws and those of others is the basis of each and all. It's the grandest gift we have to offer to each other and to open together. The differences we think we see of the people of the world are merely the icing on the cake of humanity and great nature. As many teenagers told me years ago that human beings are just flowers in the garden of life. And it's an absolute truth. Coming to that realization, that awareness, the sense of oneness, and then making it, demonstrating it, living by it, bringing the ideal into the front of our minds whenever possible, makes it real. We realize it, literally. And isn't that creative process, the process of living and setting and revising practical spiritual goals? We have plenty of time for questions and answers and discussions, and we might consider the objects of the theosophical movement or even something called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the modern scientific application of it. Yeah.
It's interesting, in the talk, the idea was presented that normally when we think of goals, it's from the personal point of view, and they're relative, they're limited. As soon as you reach one goal, you want a new one. And yet it was pointed out spiritual goals seem to have to be higher and don't have any time limits. So we were thinking perhaps a better way to understand the title, or even maybe a better word, than to think of practical spiritual guidelines or objectives, because these are not so much goals we reach to, but principles by mm-hmm. which we conduct our lives in any passage.
Yeah, and again, as we think about the difference between goals and guidelines, we're reminded again that English, there just aren't enough words sometimes for us to get to where we want to be. For the beginner, or maybe a soul who's a longstanding student but who's experiencing crisis, hooking on to specific goals that are tangible. I'm going to set the alarm clock a little bit early and give 10 minutes to reading one of the inspirational books. That goal is measurable, it can be met, and it's a tool, a springboard to the heart and the soul doing that. So maybe we start with goals that are measurable, knowing full well that that's a tiny little tool or a seed, and it's going to bloom in guidelines or the path, however we want to consider it. Way in the back.
So how does one actually come to the decision that they need to make a change, that they need to make these goals? What is it that has to happen to that person to to force them into action to do this?
That's a great question. Karma pretty much leads us or gives us enough red flags, or sometimes it's a slap upside the head of something's wrong here. That disconnect, that discontent, if you will, that sense of I have to change here, there's something really wrong, or here's the same old problem, and I'm like banging my head on the wall, I'm not getting any further. Those moments are when we have an invitation as perceiver to say, okay, let's wait for a minute and figure out what the change is. But the karmic opportunities that we have, it's not condemnation, it's not judgmental, it's not determinism. They're obstacles and explorations, oftentimes pain and suffering, become platforms where it's a time to spiral around and make a change and to look within. And that's when the search begins. There's a hand in this corner.
In our younger days, all of us have more or less have had the same experience, usually on graduation or at some other time. And we say, how far can it go? And someone always points up into the sky and says, the sky is the limit. And we've seen artwork many times where there are a bunch of young people and they're listening, but whoever it is they listen to, he has his finger pointing up into the sky. The sky is the limit.
And as children, not only were we told the sky is the limit, but shoot for the stars. If you reach for the stars and you fall short, you've gone far, far further. That statement has a tremendous impact for children. That self-fulfilling prophecy that was mentioned earlier, where some children are taught that they are miserable sinners, that they have to be saved by some personal deity, and that there's only that one way to live, that only one way to be, they'll never be anything more. Some children of color, or some children of a particular gender or two, are offered messages where you can only be in this box. This is what's available to you to be, to do, to say. And so the limits set on what can be achieved and what can be dreamed and what can be realized can differ from person to person. It's all karmic, and it's all something that with the right basis upon which to think, within those children that have been taught these limiting things, is the reality, the notion of, wait a second, that's not fair. I am, and I can be, I can grow, I can do. And it's the, I want to say trick, and that's not the right word either. It's the process of following that spiritual impulse and beginning to think outside the box. And then beginning to say, okay, I can do this, but why? For the good of the other. There was a hand here, and then there's a couple more. Yeah.
When it's so common when people talk about goals, they often talk about how important it is to envision what that goal is. And just last week we were talking about the image-making faculty, and it's mm-hmm. the king faculty, how important it is. And so when setting a spiritual goal, there's a time when we would think, okay, well, obviously the ultimate spiritual goal is the manifestation of universal brotherhood. But what does it look like? What does it feel like? What does it smell like? And that's kind of nebulous and kind of who's to say. But then we find in the philosophy, in the declaration actually, that's not the goal, in our view. We think that the goal is not a thing called universal brotherhood. The work we have on hand, the end we keep in view, so what's in view is the goal, is what? Is activity. The dissemination of the philosophy, exemplification of the fundamental principles, so teaching it, doing it, growing from it, a truer realization from it, of itself, which results in what? A deeper conviction that that's the reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess, why set it as a goal if it's already there? So the goal is, what do we need to do to recognize it for what it is? The goal is the process.
Yeah. How does the sun rise? How does the flower bloom? How does all of manifestation come to be? Very gradually, very methodically and uniformly, and the process begins in the mind, is exemplified, it's spoken, it's acted upon, it's written, it's read, and then what happens, but just like at the end of a life or at the end of the day, the possibility, the reality, what was experienced and therefore assimilated is brought back full force internally, and on the next morning we are even a soul richer because we've still got the ideal, we still have the goals, we still have the planned daily practical activities, and we have assimilated the experience gained. Isn't that a metaphor for life in many ways? Yeah.
And to go along with the previous couple comments, HPB says a wonderfully supportive statement, and we have to paraphrase it. She talks about how it doesn't matter how many times you try and fail, as long as you pull yourself back up and you keep trying. It's not the failures. It's if you don't continue to try, but as long you're it's almost like you're scoring karmic points by continuing to keep trying.
Well, if we live in our minds and we live in our hearts, and we're using the brain as a tool, and the emotions as a tool, and all the memories of all the cells are tools, then the failure would be not to use the process. You know what? A plant doesn't, from the seedling, determine, I'm going to grow today because I like the sun. There's no notion of, in the animal world, I'm going to sleep in today, forget everything else. You know, the procrastination, the fear of success, and other folks sense the fear of failure, those things are all baggage that come with karmic results of thinking in this life and in past lives. So there is no failure. There merely is the moment where we think, we act, and then we be. In other words, we have cognition, we perceive, we create, we imagine, we envision an idea or a goal or a milestone that we can use. Then we act on it, or we write on it, or we speak on it. We see what the results are. But it's the mindfulness, being in the moment, that is truly where life is.
We've always thought, and we've always heard in here, that to live a spiritual life and to is to really develop an attitude. That attitude that we have to develop is through discipline.
Yep.
We have to discipline ourselves. You know, that we have this desire to understand our spiritual side. So
we've heard in here that we should have a mantra all day long, you know, that I'm not this body. I'm not these feelings. Oh, I'm not this pain. I'm not these ideas. And you know, that's Tuesday. On Wednesday, everyone is the same as I am. Their heart and mind are not different. And but there's many that connects us to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to remind ourselves that we're not these bodies, we're not these feelings, emotions, this intellect.
Mm-hmm.
We're more than that. And I think that gives us that attitude, carries over to everything. That when you're in a conversation or in a situation, you become the observer,
mm-hmm.
rather than the participant that's reacting right away. So you already have entered the spiritual world. You're watching the physical.
Mm-hmm.
That's being here and now.
That's being here and now. That's being in the moment. And that is honoring the fact that although one, in essence, we are diverse in tendencies and in motivations, etc. But if our attitude is, I can understand this personality and the triggers of life for this personality, or I can understand this body and accept what needs to be changed in this personality, in this body, in this brain. If that's our attitude, I am witnessing or perceiving or observing what's going on with these tools, these points of contact I have, then I can do a couple of things. And we each come to this in a different way. Some of us, there's something called conation, how we like to take information and put it out. And some of the brain theory for classrooms is that some kids are quick starts. They love to brainstorm. They can chatter out a list of 20 things that the class needs to hear about. Other students are research artists, and they really love digging into a whole bunch of sources and trying to get the information about those quick start ideas. There's a third type. A conation where the person likes to organize the details. They're the ones who, as they learn and grow, are taking the ideas that they saw from the inspiration, the research that they've read and heard, and now they're organizing it. Maybe they're putting it together to see, how does this all fit? How do I understand the process of learning about the true nature of self and then exhibiting it. And the fourth type of conation is the person who listens to the quick start, reads over the research or hears about the research, listens to the organizer, and the fourth person is merely activity-based. That's the implementer, the one who says, okay, this process is all about action, and this is all about physical outcomes and manifestations. So as we begin to think about our strengths and to figure out how do we learn, why do we learn, what are the tendencies or skandhas of this life, then we balance self-discipline, compassion, and patience, don't we, for the process of change. And we chunk the process of change into little doable increments. Yeah.
We've heard a lot about being a genuine human being, and for different reasons, it's sometimes the hardest thing we can do, be a genuine human being. What does that mean in the light of a practical spiritual goal? How would you go about being a genuine?
Good question. A genuine human being walking the talk. What comes to mind?
Being
how would we recognize a genuine human being? Yes?
Open-minded.
Okay.
Very cosmopolitan. Compassionate.
Compassionate, open-minded, cosmopolitan. Your hand was up.
His actions and words are parallel the way he lives his life.
His actions and words are parallel. The way he leads his life is reflecting a motive or an attitude. He's walking his talk, yeah?
Very simple. I am a human being and a thinker. And the reading and the work that we have done today points out the way. And when we open the first two pages of the Bhagavad Gita, we're surprised. And it says independent devotion. A human being, I am a thinker. The statement is made, and fortunately, Peter pointing out of the way is important. Because many of us don't have answers to 90% of the question because we never thought that way before.
So, pointing out the way, as we look at ourselves, am I genuine or not? Am I basing my life on the system of thought that the world is evolving, that there's a natural process, that I can go with that flow, and my attitude is I can lift that flow for the good of all, one and all? Yeah.
And, I mean, it, doesn't the philosophy talk about the idea of compassion as being one of the soul powers? That it's one of the major virtues, and wouldn't a true human being be, exemplify the idea of compassion?
And compassion is key. It's a study unto itself, because isn't one of the first statements about the cosmos, one of the very first statements about the beginning of all that we measure as time, desire first arose in it. And the law of laws, pure karma, pure desire, is compassion, is it not? Yeah.
W.Q. Judge wrote an article one time. It's called The Skin of the Earth, under pen name of Brian Kinneman. And in this article, he speaks about a master showing him the planet. And he sees multiple levels of elementals working in perfect harmony and unison and uniformity and interconnectivity on multiple dimensions, multiple planes. And then he sees some of them dying, these elementals. And he asks the master, what is this black cloud on them? He says, the master tells him, these are the thoughts of men. And in this article and others that I've read very often, to me it seems that the fundamental, at least my fundamental challenge, is the ability to control my thoughts. And to do that, it almost is as if I have to step outside of myself in order to notice myself improperly thinking or temper is going south or something to that effect. So it almost implies that I have to live a duality of life, or duality of existence, where I need to always watch myself from a perspective beyond myself. I find that extremely difficult, and yet I know that if I do not master that challenge, I cannot move forward. I mean, I can easily be compassionate or helpful to others, and I understand those are essential things, but you will never improve the planet unless you improve yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is the greatest difficulty, working upon yourself, by yourself.
And that is the human condition. You have just voiced the entire process and perplexity, if you will, that every single human experiences. It's as though every fiber of the body, astral and physical, has memories and signals all of its own. It's as though, as any CB radio antenna, we're picking up on thoughts and ideas and reflexes from all around us. And key in the process is being aware that we're swimming in the ocean of life, that our attitude or our motive is, I can become aware of the monkey mind or the background noise and tune it down, not add force to it, and then start a new line of thought. It's difficult, but that's why one of the earlier comments about there is no failure. How do you set up a new habit? But you consistently make an effort that's mindful and patient and strong, that in any adversity you're going to be able to pick your mind up and move it to a different place or thought. And with enough effort, with a high motive, a high attitude, eventually that becomes habitual. And may it be in this life and not in 10 million lives from now. Right there. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
To keep in mind the other ideas that even in what we think could be a failure to keep trying, Krishna looks at it from the other point of view. He says, even a little bit of this practice delivers a man from great risk. So we may think our effort little, and that maybe it resulted in a failure in terms of our goal, but it actually prevented us from doing much greater harm to ourselves and others than we might have. We hadn't made that effort.
We don't have that purview, as was described in the Skin of the Earth, or the astronauts standing on the moon and looking back and saying, whoa, wait a minute, where's the fences and boundaries here? We don't have that. But just look what we did. The hour's up, and we've placed our minds and hearts for an hour in an unsustained and a sustained effort on a kickoff reading that's over 5,000 years old. So the struggle, so beautifully described, is what life is all about, and we have to end times over. Mm-hmm. See you Wednesday.